Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Lynn Arduzzi, an editor here at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me too. Hello, Lucy.
Hi, Thea. How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. What's new with you? I hear speak of a bookshop.
Yeah, another bookshop. So we've got another wonderful recommendation from around the world. So this is from Laura in Auckland. We're very happy to hear from Laura. She's my favourite independent bookshop in Auckland. It's on the North Shore at Milford, and it's called the Book Lover Bookshop. Owned and run by Olivia with the help of Rachel and Bria, and they will do their best to find you any book that you order. She said recently they delivered a book to my front door out of the kindness of their hearts when I was stuck at home, having had all my wisdom teeth out. That's pretty impressive, isn't it? She says, last week we went to a literary quiz night they organised. Could have done with the TLS team to help us out. I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure we could have
helped. I'm not sure we would have been much help.
Let's go with the idea that we would have been very, very helpful. They have a book club and a book subscription service, and they leave encouraging messages on the A board, you know, the sort of...
like a notice board.
Yeah, yeah, outside the shop. And she also sent some pictures of those, of which my favourite is bookshops are an excellent natural sunblock. Isn't that brilliant?
Not for me. I insist on reading in full sun. Whenever the sun is available, I'm in it.
No, but a bookshop.
Oh, bookshop, a bookshop. Yes, I thought I was thinking a book, as in because you would stay indoors and read it.
No. The edifice.
The bookshop itself. Okay, well, yes, I can't argue with that. This is true.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a brilliant shout out from Laura in New Zealand.
Well, thank you. We would always be glad to hear of more bookshops that you cherish. Coming up on this week's show... The publication of the diary of a European bureaucrat might not strike you as publishing's most exciting moment, but when you add the word secret and the diarist's name, things get decidedly more intriguing. The book is as yet available only in French, so we have Henri Astier on hand to guide us through. Plus, what does Brexit mean for publishers and writers? Our NB columnist looks into the matter. But first, the 1969 film Midnight Cowboy, directed by John Schlesinger, tells the tale of a Texan potwash called Joe Buck, played by John Voight, who packs up to make it in New York as a sex worker. He feels good about his prospects. In the first frames, he showers away his old life, unwraps fresh cowboy boots and hat, and throws on the fringe jacket so crucial to his image. He hits the road, beloved radio in hand, as if to set his own soundtrack. Unsurprisingly, things don't go as well as he had hoped. On his first job, he ends up paying the woman who was supposed to be paying him for sex. But he soon meets an ailing con man, Enrico Razzo Rizzo, played by Dustin Hoffman, and things shift gear. Which certainly isn't to say that things get better. But at least now the men have each other, and the relationship that ensues by turns hostile and tender gives the film its heart. Almost 50 years since the film's release, a book by Glenn Frankel takes a deep dive into, in Frankel's words, a dark, difficult masterpiece and the deeply gifted and flawed men and women who made it. Our writer Keith Hopper, a critic of film and literature, has reviewed it in this week's TLS and joins us now to fill us in. It's good to have you with us, Keith.
Delighted to be here.
I didn't know that Midnight Cowboy was critically not very well received. I sort of assumed when I first saw it, which was probably about 10 years ago, that it was an instant classic. I know it made lots of money at the box office and it won a bunch of Oscars. Of course, that doesn't really say much about its critical reception. But in fact, you begin with Roger Ebert's comment in 1969 that the film comes heartbreakingly close to being the movie we want it to be, as in it didn't get there. So what did he mean by that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think it was a slow burn success. There was too many problematic qualities to it. I think it was new. It's part of the new Hollywood, the new American cinema, the breakdown of the studios, the relaxing of the censorship code. So it's a film that captures Hollywood in transition. I'm not sure that people knew what to make of it. Ebert is reliable, I think. Yeah, he said it comes heartbreakingly close to being the movie you want it to be. He thought that the performances stood out. John Voight as Joe, the stud, and Dustin Hoffman as the ailing con man that he hooks up with. But that he criticized Schlesinger, who was English, born and brought up in Hampstead, that he didn't really understand the American culture that he was making his film about, and that he should have let the performances carry the film. Instead, what does he describe it? I have it here. He dropped those performances into an offensively trendy, gimmick-ridden, tarted-up, vulgar exercise in fashionable cinema.
And so, I mean, for him, it's very much then. So, I mean, to stick with Ebert for a second, what's interesting about him is that he, as you point out, he rewatches the film in 1994, so 25 years after the film came out. And he says that it remains one of, so he sort of, it sort of seems like he's changing here a little bit. He says it remains one of a handful of films that stay in our memory after the others have evaporated. So that's not to say that he loves it now at all, but he's saying that he appreciates something new in it. And he may not have meant this as a challenge when he said it, but you sort of took it as one, didn't you? You start your piece by mentioning a vox pop.
Yeah. So when I was asked to do this, as I said, I was interested in reading the book by Franco. But my memory of the film, I saw 20 years ago, and I didn't like it. I had a sense of it being slightly sleazy, seedy, which is probably the point. But I felt uncomfortable about it. So I queued it up that night and I watched it with my wife, and I didn't change my mind either. I still think it was a little seedy, a little sleazy. It feels very dated. And yet I think Ebert is right. There are moments in it that are groundbreaking. So I was interested then in that idea of how we remember, how we watch and review films. And I brought in that Pauline Kael, actually, because Kael insisted she never, the great New York critic, she never watched the film twice. What she wanted to convey was the experience of spectatorship. She gets the plot wrong all the time. I mean, she is standing in for us, sitting in the dark, eating her ice cream. And, you know, we don't always pick up exactly what's going on in our first viewing. So it was interesting to revisit in this way. And I thought, well, how do we remember films? Is Ebert right? So I did a vox pop with friends and colleagues. I've got a new job and it was a nice icebreaker with my new colleagues to say, what do you remember? But don't cheat. You know, don't Google it. Don't look at clips on YouTube. And it kind of is interesting just to see what people do remember. So a film historian remembered Dustin Hoffman wearing a white suit in the opening of the film. I had no recollection of that whatsoever. And in fact, when I watched it again, it passed me by and I had to rewind.
Yeah, it's funny. It's, I mean, that's one of the things that I most remember, his sort of his increasingly filthy white suit, which is sort of like a kind of a fallen first communicant.
Yes. So, I mean, when did you last see it? You saw 10 years ago?
So I first saw it about 10 years ago, I reckon. And then probably only last year, actually. I was going to try and watch it again before we spoke today, but I didn't get round to it. And possibly that a third time would have been would have been too much.
Yeah.
But it is very compelling, this idea, isn't it, about the way we piece together a film afterwards from the memories that we have of it. I was watching... have you seen Room 237?
Yeah.
A documentary by Rodney Asher, and it's about The Shining, and it's about all of the theories that different people have attached to the film, you know, that it's an apology for the massacre of Native Americans, or a reckoning with the Holocaust. And it sort of, in a way, doesn't really matter what the film itself was by this point, because it meant all of this to these people, and they have built a whole life on it, you know, a life for this work.
Yeah. And I think when Roger Ebert revisits it 25 years later, it had just been accepted into the Library of Congress as a film worth preserving. And I suppose when you look back on it now, it doesn't really matter whether you like the film or not, or whether it's any good or not. Its timing was good. You know, a month after it was released, the Stonewall riots broke out. And I suppose 25 years on, you look back and say, well, it was groundbreaking. It raises the issue of homosexuality in a way we hadn't really seen on screen before. Now, that's not to say its representation isn't without problems. I mean, some people find it homophobic, and there's, you know, Glenn Frankel, the author of the book, allows for that too. So it's interesting just to see that, I suppose, it marks a transitional moment. It seems to stand for something in the counterculture that will be remembered, even if it's not, I think, off the standard of, say, we mentioned Taxi Driver. Glenn Frankel, very late in the book, compares it. He said the legacy is the way that it initiates a lot of these New York films from like Clute and Dog Day Afternoon and so on. But he mentions Taxi Driver, and he picks up a really important point about it that I hadn't got on my first viewing, is that Joe Buck, the cowboy in the film, the stud, the gigolo, was in the army. Now, if he was in the army in that period, presumably he had been in Vietnam. It's never mentioned. And there's only one shot of him in his uniform. He goes back to his little sleepy town in Texas to discover that his grandmother who raised him is dead. Her shop is closed up and he's homeless. And you get a sense, it comes out more strongly, I think, in the novel, that he felt at home in the army amongst the company of men. But it is a novel, really, and a film about loneliness. But we only get that one snapshot of Joe in his uniform. And at the end, Glenn Frankel makes a very valid comparison between it and Taxi Driver, that it's both about traumatized Vietnam vets. You know, so it's an interesting film. The more you talk about it, everyone is picking something different out of it. So I suppose in that sense, it is a successful piece.
Do you think the Vietnam point and what you said about the counterculture, that's also why it's seen as an important film, because it really is on that hinge. There's Stonewall, and there's also there's a lot of souring politically, isn't there, and a lot of violence and a lot of people protesting about things. Things are beginning to change. Do you think it's got the timing right for that?
Yeah, and I mean, I can see why both Roger Ebert and Pauline Kael saw John Schlesinger as an outsider coming to America and misinterpreting the country. But actually, I thought he brought a kind of outsider's perspective to it. The kind of fascination when you see Joe walking along the streets of New York. And it struck me, actually, one of the parodies is in Crocodile Dundee, you know, the outsider in New York experiencing for the first time. I think Schlesinger has the same sensibility here. There's a sense that the city itself is a character, that it's a dangerous, violent, but exciting place. And when he's cruising around 42nd Street where the gay hustlers are, I mean, it's not clear whether Joe is utterly naive or whether there is some kind of latent homosexuality. But either way, I think there are some incredible nighttime shots of him walking down through these dark streets. And you really do get a sense of the kind of excitement. There is something in the air, but we never really find out what that is. So I think, again, I'm beginning to change my mind entirely having this conversation. I'm beginning to think, yes, it is a masterpiece because of the way it captures the disorientation of the outsider. Yeah.
So this book, Frankel's book, he works his way through the different men and women involved in the making of the film. And one of them is the cinematographer, Adam Hollander. He played a very significant role in the way that it looks, and not everyone was pleased about it, but he was an outsider as well.
They're all outsiders to some degree, because this is, I think, part of, as we said, the studio system is beginning to break down and the new Hollywood system is beginning to open up. And that's largely to do with a new style of director influenced by the author theory, I think, in the French New Wave. But these would be the film brats, people like Coppola and Scorsese and De Palma and, I suppose, to a certain degree, George Lucas even, and Steven Spielberg in their early days. You know, these are the first group of directors, unlike John Ford or Fred Zinnemann, you know, who worked their way up through the studio system to become directors. They're the first group of film brats who studied film at university. They went to film school. And I think they're bringing a different sensibility to it. You know, film language really is a history of technology. And as the technology changes, so does film language. And we started off, you know, silent, going in sound, black and white to colour. Then in the 50s, you know, when TV was a rival, we got these big cinematic cinescope screens and so on. The problem with that is that the cameras got bigger and bigger and bigger. And the camera that was typically used at the time, a Mitchell BNC, they're about the size of a small car, you know. It great on a set, not so good shooting outside. So the French New Wave, too much is made of the author, not enough of the cinematographers, the people who got these lightweight cameras left over from the Second World War. And you could basically make a film with two people, sound recordist and a camera operator. And I think Hollander is coming out of that school. So he, again, he's an outsider, but he's coming with a different sensibility. And the New York camera crew apparently disapproved because he uses natural lighting. He uses stolen shots. So these would be filmed without the knowledge or consent of bystanders. So all those shots of John Voight dressed as a cowboy walking through the streets of New York, that's all stolen footage. And there's a great energy to it, I think. And I imagine in 1969, if you were an American film goer, you had never seen anything like that before. Mm. It must have been very exciting.
On that point, I mean, there's the stars themselves, of course. They had been, you know, Dustin Hoffman had just come from The Graduate, more or less. So he was a known entity. So where were they up to in their careers at this point, Hoffman and Voight as well?
Well, that's really interesting. And just before we go on to actors, to say how collaborative it was, one of the things I really love about Frankel's book, so he gives credit to the director and to the original writer, but he brings in people, collaborators you don't always get to hear about. So there's a costume designer, Anne Roth, really innovative. She's got a lovely quote. There are actors and there are movie stars, and I don't work with movie stars. And she's signaling the arrival of the method style. I mean, you know, the method was there since the 50s with Brando and Monty Clift. This is the second generation of it, but they're a very aggressive generation that will include people like De Niro and Al Pacino. And so, as you say, Hoffman was already a very unlikely star, you know, from The Graduate in 1967. I think actually, if I have a quarrel with the film, first it's that I think it's overly influenced by The Graduate, far too much kind of soundtrack. Mm. Also, I think Schlesinger probably is in awe of Hoffman a little bit. Although he'd worked with some big actors, you know, in England, Alan Bates, Julie Christie and so on, I think this is a different style of acting. And apparently Hoffman turned up in character when he first met Schlesinger. Schlesinger was a bon viveur. He arranged to meet him in a fine Manhattan restaurant. And Hoffman turned up as Ratso with his limp and his dirty suit and so on.
That's a bold move, isn't it?
It's a bold move. And that's what Hoffman said, that he realised when he was on set that the director, Schlesinger, wanted to be surprised all the time. He said he craved collaboration. Hoffman's performance, I think, has dated. You know, it looks like he's method acting. You know, with the limp, the clothes, the greasy hair. The accent is turned up full volume, whereas I think Voight's character is much more contained, and I think it survived. And I was really interested, too, when I did my Vox Pop, the number of feminists who really found him really, really attractive, really seductive. I think it was that mixture of naivety, but also that great physical beauty, you know. So I think they got lucky. But again, I think there was a great degree of bravery in the casting, you know.
Can I pick up what you were saying about the soundtrack? As you were saying, like The Graduate is very, very, the soundtrack's very, very important in that and very heavily influenced, because the soundtrack that nearly happened for it, they had an astonishing selection of songs to choose from, didn't they?
Again, what fascinated me about this was not only how we misremember, but the things that didn't make it into the film seem more interesting than some of the things that did. So, you know, a lot of people remember Everybody's Talking, performed by Harry Nilsson. That was a temp track. So that means that when they're in the editing studio, they play this to help guide the edits. And then Schlesinger eventually thought that the emotional spirit of the lyrics captured the lead character's subjectivity. But the songs that didn't make the cut, so Joni Mitchell wrote The Ballad of Midnight Cowboy, but it was found to be too literal. And in fact, you know, if you listen to it and read the lyrics, you know, it's almost like a Greek chorus on the film. It wouldn't have worked. The fascinating ones are Leonard Cohen singing Bird on the Wire over the phone to the producer.
Yeah, so is this before he's released Bird on a Wire? Is it for the film?
No, he didn't write it for the film, but he very much wanted it to be in the movie.
But he had that song and he said, well, because it seemed to me that Bird on a Wire would have been very good as well.
It would have been incredibly evocative. And the really fascinating one was Bob Dylan wrote Lay Lady Lay for the film, but he delivered it too late. Can you imagine Midnight Cowboy with Lay Lady Lay? You know, those scenes where the first woman that Joe encounters in his new career as a gigolo turns out to hustle him. That would have been interesting to have something like Lay Lady Lay. A later scene when he does actually get a first and only paying customer, beautiful actor, Brenda Vaccaro. I think she takes some of the misogynistic sting out of it. But again, you can imagine that Lay Lady Lay would have worked beautifully there. So it's not only how we misremember a film, it's about how we reimagine it, thinking about all the possibilities that were there.
Well, in the end, the critics, and we'll do it now as well, always come back to the duo at the film's heart, Joe and Ratso. They tend to be compared to Lenny and George in Of Mice and Men, but you have your own theory. I think it's really convincing, given Schlesinger's background as well, about the tradition in which the couple sits.
Yeah, so, I mean, Frankel mentions Steinbeck, Lenny and George, and compares it to Ratso and Joe. I mean, it's an easy comparison. But I thought a more powerful precursor was Beckett. When you think of Didi and Gogo and Waiting for Godot, or Ham and Clove, that kind of mutually dependent sadomasochism in Endgame. And I think that, to me, that makes sense, because not only was Schlesinger began his career in the theatre in London in the 1950s, when Beckett would have been the big thing. James Hurley, who wrote the novel, Jim Hurley, he had gone to Black Mountain College, a very experimental place, had become friends with Anais Nin. He moved out to the Pasadena Playhouse, again, very groundbreaking in his time in California, became a playwright, wrote some very groundbreaking stuff, a play called Blue Denim in 1957, which was about teenage pregnancy and abortion. I mean, very daring stuff. So they would have been aware of avant-garde theatre. So I think, I didn't go into it in that detail, but I think it makes sense of it, this idea of European absurdism, because there's a strange self-reflexivity that I had forgotten and misremembered. But again and again throughout the film, Joe is preening, looking at himself in the mirror. He's never had anyone to tell him that he's good, he's handsome. He's making it up himself, and he's constantly looking in the mirror. And when he turns around to capture his reflection in the mirror, he breaks the fourth wall. So it's this constant kind of looking out into the audience. I mean, Midnight Cowboy, the title probably works on lots of different levels, but the idea of him watching movies all the time, he's created his own persona. Because he's been neglected, he simply watches movies. The opening shot, it's a little contrived, but it's a slow pullback, and we get this long shot of a deserted drive-in cinema in Texas. And in front of it, very unlikely, is a little boy in a cowboy suit riding a little wooden rocking horse. I mean, I don't know what a little boy is doing riding a rocking horse in front of an empty drive-in. But again, once you realise by the end of the film that perhaps this is about traumatised memory, particularly of a Vietnam vet, it is a symbolist film. These are all images that are being thrown in together that captures the subjectivity of this damaged man whose life has been built around movies.
Well, if all that doesn't make people want to go and watch the film again, possibly while listening to Dylan, I don't know. I don't know. Will.
What I would say too is, as part of writing this, it was a really fun thing to do. I hadn't heard of the novelist, James Lee O'Hurley. He wrote a couple of books, All Fall Down, which I've just bought, and The Season of the Witch. I really recommend him. He's kind of fallen off the map, but the novel of Midnight Cowboy is really interesting. It's in the third person, but punctuated with these long scenes of interior monologue. And I think while I'd plug the film, I would certainly recommend Jim Hurley to
Excellent. Well, Keith Hopper, thank you very much for that recommendation and for talking us through the film. It's been lovely talking to you.
Lovely talking to you.
Still to come on the show, what does Brexit mean for publishers and writers, and the secret diary of the most dangerous man in Europe? And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. And we are happy to announce the return of the exclusive TLS subscription offer, exclusive that is, to our podcast listeners. For just £5 or $5 or the equivalent in whatever currency you use, you will receive 6 issues of the TLS, and that's print and digital. So you'll have the paper turning up on your doorstep every week, where you'll find all the pieces we've talked about on this podcast, alongside dozens of other pieces, as well as getting access to everything online and in the app edition, should you find yourselves waiting for a bus without your print issue handy. The digital access also includes the website and app archives and the historical archive, which goes back to 1902. So you can look up Walter de la Mare and T.S. Eliot and read what Virginia Woolf made of D.H. Lawrence, Joseph Conrad and Aldous Huxley. There's original writing by Roland Barthes, Saul Bellow, John Updike, Muriel Spark, Chinua Achebe, Patricia Highsmith, Umberto Eco and Susan Sontag, and poems by Hardy, Auden Frost, Plath, Larkin, Brodsky, Paul Muldoon and Anne Carson. So there's really quite a lot to be getting on with. Go to the-tls.co.uk/pod to take up this offer.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. Before we sneak a read of this secret diary we're teasing you with, let's turn briefly to this week's NB column, because there's some thematic overlap that will become apparent. Our writer, the ever mysterious MC, directs our attention to the impacts of Brexit only now being felt by publishers and writers. Lucy, can you give us a gist?
Yes, so it's quite complicated, but I can read out what other people have said about it, which is it's the way to ensure that I do this properly. It's that in June, the Intellectual Property Office launched a consultation regarding creations of the mind, which sounds cool, and copyright exhaustion, which doesn't. But as MB says, it's a complicated business relating to international markets and a potential undercutting of earnings about books being sold around the world and then re-imported to the UK. And so there's a quote from Tom Weldon, who's the CEO of Penguin Random House UK, and he says, "Prior to leaving the EU, Britain was part of an agreement which allowed the free flow of books around Europe, while crucially ensuring that when an author's work was sold at lower price points around the globe, those same copies could not be resold into the domestic market. But it's possible now that these safeguards will be removed, which I think the danger is that then there will be lots of very cheap imports into the market, which means that the publishers, and especially presumably the small publishers and the authors, would lose out.
Wouldn't be able to compete with those cut down prices. So do we have a sense of what, you know, what sort of loss we're talking about? Are there any numbers?
Well, I think it's all guesswork. MC talked to a campaign called Save Our Books, who are, you know, understandably worried about this, backed by the Publishers Association, Society of Authors, Association of Authors Agents, Authors Licensing and Collecting Society. And they thought that it might be as much as a 25% drop in revenue from physical sales. Apparently, there is an official sort of pronouncement that says, well, they did this in New Zealand and it's fine. But I don't know. Presumably, the circumstances are very different. The thing is, nobody knows.
No, and the other thing is that forever, the British government seems to just point to other countries and say, "Oh, look, it worked out fine there in this one other country."
Yeah, and I think the problem is that as usual, I mean, it's going to it will impinge as most things do on small businesses, small publishers. You know, the great big houses don't want to take a cut, but they could if they had to. Smaller ones, I think, just can't. The consultation closes on August 31st, we should say, if people want to find out about it or, you know, write about it or anything.
Oh, well, they can write to their MPs.
They can.
I think you can write to your MPs. You can get you can do that. But yes, it's true. I mean, if Penguin Random House, the you know, money-making giant that it is, worries about the cost of things, you do have to ask what that means for the small and independent presses. But there's another change, and this is not a word that I necessarily thought I would say on the TLS podcast, but it has to do with VAT regulations.
Yeah, we're all about talking about VAT regulations. Let's do 5 minutes on VAT regulations. I don't understand the ins and outs of it, and I think it is actually genuinely quite complicated, but I think the deal is that small businesses will have to register with the EU now from Britain, small businesses from Britain, which obviously includes small publishers, and VAT is applicable on all sales at the rate charged in the customer's country. So that will introduce a new expense, presumably an absolute huge new load of admin, I think, and a new expense. And the problem is that already some of the smaller publishers are won't be able to sell directly to the EU, or, you know, will certainly limit who they have to sell to.
Well, yeah, I mean, I this is purely anecdotal, but this is the only level on which I can participate. Just the other day, I had an email from a publisher, a big publisher, which I won't name, telling me that they can't send a book to my reviewer who's based in Italy because they've just been slapped with this massive new VAT bill and it becomes prohibitive. So I suppose that does make me wonder how we're supposed to keep our community of writers and readers as open and as international as we always have. No one can answer that right now, I don't suppose. But it's a sorry old mess, isn't it?
the thing is that I think it's also it's uncertainty. It's not clear yet what's going to happen. I mean, maybe they will keep the safeguards and it'll be fine. Maybe they won't, and people will have lots of extra expense. But the uncertainty is certainly very difficult to live with. And, you know, it's lovely talking about books and thinking about books and all of that. But people have to be able to make a living from it. Otherwise, there'll be far fewer books for us to talk about.
Exactly. And in the midst of all this uncertainty, if there's one thing that we can be certain about, it's that the British tabloids will blame Europe for all of this. So that leads us nicely on to your segment, Lucy, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, because this week we are looking into the secret diary of the figure called by some the most dangerous man in Europe. Not a head of state, a shady advisor, or a tech renegade, but a bureaucrat. Michel Barnier, the EU's Brexit negotiator, has published a book called La Grande Illusion, Journal Secret du Brexit. As you might have guessed, it's in French, as yet untranslated. So we've asked our reviewer, Henri Astier, to unravel its mysteries for us. And we're delighted that Henri is here today to talk to us about it.
Yes, I'm very happy to be here.
So the title of it, La Grande Illusion, it has a couple of references, and the subtitle has got quite another one for British readers. Can you unpack them for us, please?
The La Grande Illusion is, of course, a masterpiece of French cinema, filmed by Jean Renoir from 1937. And I suppose that Barnier, at the beginning of the book, says that he was thinking of this great film, presumably because it's about wartime enmity between German and French officers during the First World War, I suppose, although it doesn't really elaborate on that. And the second reference that Barnier talks about is the Great Illusion, which is the famous book by, a famous essay by Norman Angell. Is that how you pronounce his name? On the perils of nationalism that was published just before the First World War. So this is what Barnier says. For me, it's the secret diary was more evocative of that of Adrian Mole, just yes. Because Adrian Mole has a brush with the world of Westminster politician that he finds very difficult to deal with, and so does Monsieur Barnier.
I wonder, actually, because as we're saying, I think it's being translated perhaps right now. I wonder if they will go with the secret diary. I bet they don't, actually, for that reason, because...
I bet they don't. I think that it's going to pose a few challenges, I think, for translators, because he's got Barnier has as an epigraph, a quote from King Lear, which does not exist. He made it up, I don't know where he got it from.
That's bold. He made up his own Shakespeare.
It's a very strong move, isn't it?
Something about banish reason. I wish I had the book in front of me. I should, but I don't. So how are they going to translate that spurious quote?
Well, his Shakespearean ambitions aside, what kind of book is it? Is it like a diary? On Monday, I went to Poland, did some negotiating, and had X for breakfast. Or is it a very careful construct? Which is it? Or is it something in between?
It's a bit of both. I think the basis of it is a day-to-day diary. So, I had breakfast with David Davis. I met the Polish Prime Minister. We discussed this and that. He elaborates quite a lot. And it's clear that some bits are in hindsight. So it's mostly a straightforward diary, though.
I know this isn't really the point, but what's he like as a prose stylist? I mean, I note the use of the phrase two to tango, which is always slightly worrying.
He actually is surprisingly good. I was expecting a lot of EU jargon, and there is a little bit of that, especially in the introduction, but he actually is able to write quite clearly, quite lucidly, and quite briefly. So I think both for a bureaucrat and for a French politician, he is a good writer.
Well, that's good to know. And can you remind us? I was alluding to this in the trails and in the introduction. Why he was called by some British tabloids the most dangerous man in Europe?
Yes, I think that was a very good point that you made in your introduction, because he was seen by many in the British press and in the tabloids in general as a rabid Anglophone. It's completely unwarranted. That is not true at all. His background is he was a senior minister in various center-right French governments. He was the foreign minister for a while, and he was never seen as a contender for the top job. He was a rather grey, withdrawn figure, quite cautious, a consensus seeker. When the centre-right was voted out of office in 1997 in France. He decided to seek a career in the European Union. He became an EU commissioner. He had had previous lower ranking jobs with the EU, so was familiar with the way Brussels worked. And there as well, he was widely respected as a safe pair of hands, which is, I think, key to his being picked for the job as a Brexit negotiator in June 2016. He was not seen as somebody who would rock the boat. It was very important. He was picked by the president of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker at the time. Barnier was ideal. He was not a self-promoter. He was a strong EU man who understood the virtues of consensus. And he also had, obviously, very good contacts in the French government. So his nomination was seen as the safest course from the EU's point of view. And that was not at all how it was perceived on this side of the channel. It was described as a declaration of war, I think, by the Sun. Even the Independent, I think, said that it was a provocation by Jean-Claude Juncker to nominate him, which it certainly wasn't.
When we get into the book, given that that's the sort of figure he is, once the referendum has happened, Does his diary reveal a very different approach to Brexit between Britain and the EU countries? I'm thinking about what you talk about in terms of organisation and practicality.
The UK was completely unprepared. There was no plan for Brexit. It was just put to a vote without any clear vision. We didn't really know what it meant. The British weren't sure what they were exactly voting for, just out of the EU without any details. On the EU side, things were very different, because as soon as David Cameron won the 2015 election on the promise of holding such a referendum, they sensed danger. And they set in motion a whole process with a commission actually headed by a British civil servant, Jonathan Fall, and they put all the processes in motion, so that if it came to that, if the referendum was for leave, they had the whole negotiation tactics and strategy worked out.
Mm-hmm. So this is not anything to do with political position, whether you thought it should be leave or remain. This is just a question of one side was really organised about it and the other side actually had to do a lot of catching up.
Yes, because on the EU side, obviously, whether it was leave or remain was out of their hands. So all they had just to prepare for the worst and minimise the damage, because it was always clear, and Barnier says it right from the start, and all other EU leaders have said it. Brexit was lose-lose. Everybody was going to lose. The question is, how can we limit the damage and make the best out of a very bad situation?
You say that he was chosen for this job because he was a quiet sort, not one for self-promotion. To publish this book isn't exactly the act of a shy and retiring man, I suppose. But I also saw something about a potential presidential bid for next year's French elections. Is that founded? I just saw it briefly.
Yes, I saw that as well. There are reports, but he's 71 years old. I don't think that this is going to happen. I don't think that he has the bottle for that sort of thing. And I think that he acquired a lot of a high profile in the process of these negotiations, and that might have given him some ideas or people around him, but he, you know, he is at his age, you don't reinvent yourself as a potential leader. People like, or potential.
Well, I mean, Joe Biden would disagree.
No, but he's been doing it for years, hasn't he?
I suppose, I know, but I mean, in terms of age, that his being 71, we seem to live in a world in which it doesn't matter anymore.
I'm not being ageist. Certainly, I'm not in a position to be ageist. But Joe Biden had his first presidential bid when he was in his 40s. And, you know, Barnier, he's just not that type of person. He's not the driven type like Mitterrand, who spent decades seeking that job, or Chirac. Or even Sarkozy. So I don't think that this is going to happen. You have to be ruthless. And I don't think this is going to work.
Actually, speaking of that, I was going to say, you say, like, he's much kinder, you say, about, for instance, Theresa May than many people in her own party. He doesn't see the book. You don't think he's not trying to use it as a means of taking revenge or getting back at anyone or anything like that?
Absolutely not. And that was actually one of the things that surprised me most by in reading this book, is that, first of all, yes, he is very kind to Theresa May. You know, he says repeatedly she's a courageous woman who decided to voted or was against Brexit, but courageously stepped up to get the job done. He has nothing but kind words for her. He also has kind words for David Davis, a hard Brexiteer. He is not at all an Anglophobe. On the contrary, he pays repeatedly homage. And in general, you know, he really is very impressed by the quality of the British public service. He is also, he has very, very kind words, very impressed, and I think any French person, or certainly I was, by the debate in the Commons, the quality of the debate, because it is often, the public debate was very acrimonious. But if you listen to what was said in Parliament, it was really, you really have substantive discussions, serious discussions, and it was it was not really name calling, and he also talks about that as well.
And finally, can you explain to us, tell us your thoughts about what the process has to do with ideas that go all the way back to the Enlightenment?
Yes, I think that what really struck me in all this, and this is perhaps another aspect of his Anglophilia, Barnier's Anglophilia, is that the way that the British conducted the negotiation was very much out of character, and that really surprises Barnier, because there were once the decision to leave the European Union was made by the British people, it was a democratic decision that commanded respect, and you couldn't deny that it was the will of the British people, albeit 52-48 is not a landslide, but still it's a majority. But once that decision was made, the way to implement it, how are we going to make it work, was done completely from number 10, and there were Parliament, both Theresa May and Johnson, try to sideline Parliament, and they had to be made there were some Supreme Court rulings that said, no, you have to, it has to be a Parliament has to have a say. There was no attempt to actually actively involve Parliament or the constituent parts of the United Kingdom in those negotiations, which is in complete contrast with what happened on the EU side. And the EU side, there was Parliament was consulted, the EU Parliament was consulted every step of the way. There was a committee to watch Barnier, but in the building with him. So they were involved, EU MPs were involved. And as we said, the governments, were all the governments were involved as well, whether directly when he flew there or through the Council of Ministers. And the idea there that I get from that is that it was Britain who taught the world, you know, in the 18th century, that decision, central decision by diktat, doesn't really work. If you consult people, you have a legitimacy that you don't when it's the product of one person imposing his or her will. And that's very much an Enlightenment idea. That's what Britain taught Europe at in the 18th century. And I think that now the Europeans were united precisely because they had these consultation. And however much the British tried to divide the EU, they were not able to, just because of those systems put in place, just to make sure that everybody within the Europe was on the same page and trusted that single negotiator that was Barnier was.
Well, Henri, thank you very much for enlightening us about that today.
Okay, thank you very much.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Keith Hopper and Henri Astier. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Ben Mitchell. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.